Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for 40 years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m. here on W2VL and as well as Selden, we get together and we talk about technology and science and hopefully educate each other and entertain each other. So I'm glad that you're here with us tonight, this Sunday night, when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the link. Okay? If you want to reach me and you can't get me on the radio, then email is the best way. That would be either for mailbag questions, questions that you can't reach the repeater to ask during the technical net, or if you have a topic that you want to discuss or hear discussed or be part of a discussion, or if you have a puzzle. We have a couple of puzzles sitting around. Hopefully I'll be able to at least pull one of them out tonight, maybe both. We'll see how things work out. But if you have a puzzle to share, please email it to me, and if I can kind of maneuver it into a TechNet puzzle, I will try my best. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some space or NASA-related stories, my email address is mailbag@acdesk.com. That's mailbag@acdesk.com. If you want to directly contact Paul, his email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. I have a link page. All kinds of interesting YouTube and articles are available there. It's up 24/7. There's another great Veritasium YouTube that adds on to a previous one where he describes the fact that electric fields are the way that currents and electrical energy is transferred from source to load. Please check it out at your convenience. The link will be available 24/7. And the link page can be reached by typing into your browser roy.ac2gs.com. There's a chat room available if you're so inclined. All you have to do to get there is type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. We have an audio stream. If you have friends or people that would like to listen to the technical net, but they're not in the area or they don't have an antenna, just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the audio stream. And, of course, I'd like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has an archive of these technical nets that go as far back as September of 2006. His site, amateurradio.tv, has already over 1 million visitors, so add to the number. And I want to remind people that if you hear something, report it. RFI@limark.org, mail site to report any weird signals. Give them the time that you heard it, the signal strength, and any other information you can provide. So let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what I got planned. Okay, we're going to have a regular session. It's going to be a request to people to ask questions of amateur radio technology-related questions at first, you know, relatively short questions at first, as time goes on. After those people have put down their name and their call sign, we'll cover other aspects of science, physics, chemistry, electronics, even medicine. We do not treat or diagnose over the radio, but we can discuss it if you're so inclined. I have some puzzles, so I'll throw them out if and when it seems appropriate and we have the time. And that should take us to about 10:15, and Paul, WS2N, will give us the SpaceNet report until about 11 o'clock, and I'll return and tie a bow on it and wish you a good week. That's the plan. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you a little bit of information I've discovered over this past week. Okay, as I mentioned previously, the FCC has decided to charge $35 for new licenses, for changes in licenses that would reset your expiration date. That price is $35, and it was supposed to go into effect April 19th. Now, that required the FCC to modify their software on their computers to allow for a payment of that $35, and apparently they got it all wrong, because since April 19th, no PE group can apparently apply any licenses. So if you were unfortunate enough to have passed your exams after April 19th, as far as I'm aware, the FCC is not yet able to register it in their databases. Hopefully soon they will figure things out and fix the problem, and the new licenses will be active. So I just wanted to tell everyone that, because there was a little blip in the road. The FCC apparently had notified some VE groups that they had fixed the problem last Saturday, but apparently that is not the case, or at least not the case as far as I'm aware. So, with that in mind, you know, if you have any friends who are waiting for their license to show up on the database, tell them to just be a little bit more patient, and with a little bit of time and good luck, the FCC will fix their little problem. Let me drop for a second, then I'll come right back and we'll get some questions. Okay. Anyone out there who has any questions of a technical nature, preferably if you have amateur radio-related... as time goes on, we'll allow for any science, technology, or even medicine-related questions or comments. So with that in mind, please give me your first name and your call sign.
82 OGC. I feel like that the FCC is so shorthanded, and with all these things, it's just too much out of the way to even get these people, even though... we're trying everything to, but I feel like they don't even give warnings anymore. They just straight up give the fine.
Okay, I'm a little confused, Craig. Do you want to be put on the list and we could discuss it, or you just wanted to make the comment and leave it at that?
I just wanted to throw that out there since you brought it up.
Okay, I wasn't talking about fines. I was talking about fees. There's a big difference between fees and fines. Although they begin with F. Fees are registration fees. We pay them at the DMV. We pay them for a lot of things. We had a discussion a month or two ago about what people thought about it, the idea of paying a fee, rights versus privileges, and what have you. As far as penalties, the FCC tends to be really sluggish in paying penalties. There are numerous cases of people who violated FCC regulations for almost a decade before the FCC finally smacked them silly and fined them. We had a previous member here in the club who basically abused the repeater and many people associated with the club, and I think it took something like 2 years for the FCC to fine him. So I don't think they fine people too quickly, and very often if you plead poverty, they will cut the penalty significantly. It's the fee that they're having problems with now, the registration fee.
I know that member. It's a shame that I never really got to meet them in person, but whatever. I mean, I don't even know if they, like, give the warnings anymore, like, what you're doing is illegal and you need to cease and desist, versus just straight out handing the fine, mainly for just unlicensed operation. I mean, like, sure, we try to give the warnings to these people that are actually licensed, and if they don't want to listen, then the feds will tell them, you better listen to us now, or you're getting slapped. So, pick your poison.
Well, in my experiences, what I've known of cases, I've never heard where they just kind of descend upon the individual and say, okay, you have to pay us a lot of money now. Usually they come down, they sniff around, they ask a bunch of questions, they tell them, look, we really think you did it, and eventually we're going to prove that you did it, and then we're going to penalize you, so please don't do it anymore. And usually they kind of come down on them at least two times before they actually start sending them notices that that they're in trouble. Now, the gentleman who experienced that locally, I distinctly remember he received a warning in writing from the FCC, which he decided to dismiss as his exoneration. So Again, I'm more than willing to say nasty things about government agencies, but I think in the case of the FCC, if anything, they tend to drag on these problems rather than jump on them. Partially due to their inclination, partially due to their not too significant budgeting for any of this.
Your driver's license is a privilege, not a right. Your ability to vote is a privilege, not a right. And the exact same thing with being federally licensed to transmit is also a privilege, not a right. And technically, with that license, they reserve the right to, I wouldn't probably say bang down your door, but they do reserve the right to come to you, look at your station, they can take your stuff away, and even take you to jail if you really want to give them a hard time. Yet, sometimes it can happen to people right away, and sometimes it just takes time, but hey, what can you do? KD2OGB.
BHD.
Yes, Jim.
Good evening. I see we're piling on early tonight. This is KD2BHD. Jim. Definitions of words are necessary to have discussions. People have rights. Governments have powers. Governments have no rights whatsoever for your consideration. Over.
Okay. I would disagree with Craig's understanding that voting is a privilege. Voting is a right. It's in the Constitution. There are cases where your rights can be removed. That doesn't really delineate the difference between rights and privileges. But I would start out by saying that your right to vote as an American citizen is a right, not a privilege.
Oh, really? What if you are convicted of a felony? You definitely lose your guns, and you certainly would lose your right to vote. You sure about that?
Well, yeah, and especially since you use the phrase right to vote, which kind of begs the question that it's a right. You can have your rights removed. Your rights are not set in stone. You have the right to bear arms, but if you violate other laws, those rights can be canceled for you. And as you mentioned, if you are a felon, convicted felon, you lose right to vote. But it's still a right, it's not a privilege. You don't have to take an exam, pretty much, to vote. You just have to be able to prove that you are a citizen of the United States and that you're over 18 years of age and that you're not a convicted felon or anything else that the law would constitute loss of those rights. So it's a right, not a privilege. Anyway, we seem to kind of crisscross with the politics net. Anyway, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limar Technical Net. So, for people out there with technical questions, if you would like to entertain them, if you have a question or a comment, please hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
And to extend for the science section.
Okay, Wesley, I have you down for the science section, and I will try my best not to have you slide down the list, unfortunately, what happened last week. But we'll see how things happen. It may very well that we'll be moving on to science very, very quickly. Once again, if anyone has any technical questions or any other type of questions, please give me your first name and your call sign.
WA2ZDH, John, with a question on power amplifiers.
Okay, John, what's your question?
Oh, okay, I'm on. It has to do with DNA. I know an emitter follower has, or a source follower for that matter, pretty much unity voltage gain. So somebody would say you take 20 log of V out over V at 0 dB, but getting power gain. Like 1K and driving a 50 ohm load and you have one millivolt in there, so the one millivolt on 1,000 ohms, that's one milliwatt, and that same one millivolt on the 50 ohms, something like one volt into 1,000 ohms is 1 milliwatt, and one volt across 50 ohms, the output load, 20 milliwatts. So there's the gain. So the question is, which is it, or is it just a matter of semantics? Okay. I would imagine it's a matter of semantics, personally, but not being an electrical engineer, I'd be interested in other people's input about this. Say again, I only heard a very, very partial bit of transmitted voice.
I'm sorry, Ray, this is Mike, WYTU. I'm on an HT. If you wait 2 seconds, I have to run downstairs to get on my base radio, over.
Yeah, sure, Mike, we can wait for you. No problem at all. Okay, so we're going to have Mike answer this one, which is good.
When you can, I don't know if you heard my last thing or not, because there was a mic stuck open or something.
Okay, Craig, tell me what you said. I don't know if you're coming through Plainview, Selden, or Glen Oaks. Sometimes the link between the two gets kind of broken, and I don't hear the person talking on the other repeater.
The last thing I said, and I'm actually going to let you guys carry on, but the last thing I mentioned was from voting and holding firearms, actually. So technically you weren't fully right. There are ways to have it revoked. KD2OGB.
I'm here, guys. WYTU.
Okay, very good, Mike. And just as an afterthought to Craig, yes, you can have rights revoked. You could have them limited. You could do all kinds of things, and they do that with voting. They do that with firearms. They do that with a whole bunch of other things. So rights are the difference in my mind between a right and a privilege is that a privilege has to be earned by something, and a right is inherent to your position as a citizen of the United States. But again, that's more for the political net. So, Mike, do you want to answer John's question?
Yeah, sure. I'd be very happy to. John? Okay, you're quite right in saying that an emitter follower, source follower, or a cathode follower, if you went to tubes, does have unity voltage gain, and you're absolutely correct about that. But don't convert it to dBs yet. Just assume it has a voltage gain of 1, unity. Now, think about the current gain, though. You have a high input impedance, and I think the example you used was 1 volt across 1,000 ohms, which is 1 milliampere, okay, of current. So you're driving current into the input of the device is 1 milliampere, and what you said, I believe, was that the output is to drive 50 ohms, which is 1 volt across 50 ohms, or 20 milliamps. Therefore, it has a current gain of 20. A voltage gain of 1, a current gain of 20. If you want the power gain, you simply multiply the product of voltage gain times power gain, then take the 10 times the log of that, and that's where you get 13 dB. So it's not a matter truly of semantics. You have to think of two quantities, voltage gain separately and current gain separately. Back to net, WY2U.
But yeah, fine business. As a matter of fact, the voltage gain formula, 20 log V out over V in, but if the impedance are different, you have to add to that 10 log R in over R load. If we're developing that voltage across different impedance, that 20 log only holds all by itself if we're across the same impedance. So I realize that, and when you do that correction, that 10 log of R in over R load, that picks up the extra 13 dB. But I just heard people so often refer to emitter followers as unity voltage gain, but I have never seen it in terms of dB. So I'm wondering what the convention was. Go ahead.
If I can have it one more time there, real quick.
Yeah, sure. First Mike, then Wesley.
No, you're not wrong, John. Voltage gain definition is V out divided by V in. That's voltage gain. Voltage gain in dB is 20 times the log of V out divided by V in. If the output voltage and input voltage are equal, as is the case in an emitter follower, the voltage gain, and again, I'm saying voltage gain is 0 dB, unity. So there's no translation of impedances required at all. It's simply the definition. Current gain, similarly, is I out divided by I in. dB, 20 times the log of I out divided by I in. Again, no translation of impedance is necessary. Same with power gain. Power gain is P out over P in, regardless of the impedance. Now, what I think you might be alluding to, let me drop a second. If the impedances are exactly equal, in other words, let's say you have a 50-ohm system where the input impedance of a device and the output impedance of a device are exactly equal to the same number, 50 ohms, then the voltage gain, power gain, current gain are all equal in dB, and you can prove that for yourself with some math. Okay, back to net, WI2U.
Yeah, a quick comment? Yeah, John, comment.
I remember Dick always said that when using dB, only refer to it as gain. You don't use separate voltage gain or power gain. You just refer to it as gain. So I think it may be a bit of a semantics. If I was to use that correction formula with the difference in load, the difference in impedances, I do get 13 dB, and the 13 dB power gain that with the 50 ohm load and the 1,000 ohm input impedance does give you essentially power gain. So I'm just not sure whether you refer to it as gain or voltage gain or current gain. I always thought when it came to dB gain. Go ahead.
No, I don't think so. I think when you talk the word gain, you have to be very specific about what you mean. You could have a loss in voltage and still have power gain, believe it or not. You can have a gain in current and have less power gain if the voltage translation is such where it's less than one. So, no, I'm not sure I agree with you there, John. I think when you talk about gain, you better be specific about what you mean, either voltage or current or power. Go ahead.
I see. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. That makes everything jive together. So, yeah, I appreciate it. Okay, thanks very much. Back to that.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mike. Thanks, John, for asking the question. Wesley, you wanted to make a comment about this.
I not understand properly the problem here because from the practicality standpoint, you have a 1 watt is delivered to the system, and the system has the proper impedance match of 1,000 ohm. And then you have exactly the same system, but it is 75 ohm or 50 ohm, and you have a proper impedance matching. If we assume that losses are similar, you have no gain. Now, you're talking about voltage, you guys were talking about the current and talking about the power. Voltage times current gives you power. And to exceed.
Well, I personally don't have any comment for that, but John, do you have any comment for that?
Well, yeah, I agree. Voltage times current does give you power. And in the example I gave, as far as the power in and power out, you can see you're putting in 1 milliwatt and you are getting 20 milliwatts out because that same 1 volt is developed across 50 ohms, but at the input it's developed across 1,000 ohms. So yeah, I would agree as far as power, you are getting 13 dB gain. Now that makes sense. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. I mean, in my mind, and again, I'm not an electrical engineer, the problem is with me that decibels can be a bunch of different things. Decibels can just be a logarithmic ratio, but in electronics, they tend to denote power ratings. And so when you give decibels of voltage, you give it two times the voltage, which is the power. So to me, it's somewhat semantic as well as other things, because there's a lot of wiggle room for misinterpretation of what people are using the term decibels for.
Yeah, well, you see, the thing that I guess confused me a little bit is that I've always seen decibels start with power, like the starting place is 10 log P out over P in. And then what they do, they replace a P in over R in,
and out with V out squared over R load. And then when you put that into the log, the 2 comes down from the squaring of the voltage, because the log of something raised to the second power is 2 times the log. That's where we get the 20, or 20 log V out over V in. But if the R in and the R load are different, and don't cancel, you're left also with a 10 log R in over R load, which is like a correction factor. So I've always seen the dot with power and then work towards the voltage with that correction factor thrown in there at the end if you're getting the voltages across different different resistance.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I see it is, at least in physics, when you leave physics and you just go into other uses of decibels, that the term decibel is a power rating. So you can do power ratings in terms of watts or in terms of voltages, and you square the voltage, or in the logarithm, you double the number of decibels. So in physics, decibel is a ratio of powers. You can use different units to define the ultimate ratio of powers. So that's where I'm thinking, in some fuzzy cases, it can be a semantic argument, because some people out there think of decibels as purely just ratios, not ratios of power, that physics tends to only use it for, at least where I've seen it used.
WY2U.
Yes, Mike.
Yeah, okay, I don't want to confuse the issue, but there are, like you said, Roy, several situations where dBs are assigned a personality. Sometimes in receiver work, especially in hi-fi work, they express the receiver gain as dB microvolts. In other words, so many dB above or so many dB above a microvolt. In radar, we used to have a really crazy unit, dBA, talking about area as the square, it's the correctable area of the reflecting target, you know, so many dB above or below 1 meter squared. So, again, they can have personalities depending on exactly what you're trying to express. But in all cases, it is a logarithmic representation. Go ahead.
Yeah, comment. Yeah, John, just one second. Yeah, it's obviously a decibel is a logarithmic function. The only problem that I have is I get the sense, I might be completely wrong, that when AT&T first coined the term in honor of Alexander Graham Bell, it was primarily designed to be a ratio of powers. And people found that logarithmic ratios are very useful and extended their use outside of purely power ratios. And that's where you get a problem with having to really well define what your type of decibel really is. John, you want to say something?
I agree about the flavor of the, like DBM. Once you put a subscript on it, you're actually talking about a power. Like if I say plus 23 dBm, we're talking 200 milliwatts, because it's understood that we're referencing to 1 milliwatt. Or like the cable companies like to use dBmV, because they know that everything that they're going to hook up is going to be 75 ohm impedance. There is no question about what they're developing that voltage across when they say MV. It's dB with reference to 1 millivolt, because it's understood everything is going to be 75 ohms. So yeah, I know. Once you get a subscript on a dB, you're talking an actual level signal. Okay.
That is quite correct.
Yeah, but as Mike mentioned, most of what we're talking about, thankfully, is different aspects of power. Whereas decibel of area, I don't know, Mike. Is that in any way, shape, or form similar to ratios of power? I don't see areas as being ratios of power. So I think that's an example of where they took a very useful mathematical notation and used it for something that isn't an actual ratio of power itself.
Well, no, it is not. But when you use that same area to calculate the return power in watts or dBm or whatever, that is where the reflectivity constant comes to play. Because if the bigger the target area, the more power you're going to get received. If you can get, if you understand what I'm saying there, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay, so it's related to power, but I don't think it's directly a power ratio. Would that be correct?
That is correct, yes. It's related to power because, again, the bigger the receiving aperture as far as reflectivity is concerned, the more power you will have from the radar return. There was something else I wanted to say. I lost my thought for a moment. Okay, I'll probably get it back in a moment. Back to that, WY2U.
WB2EAZ showing up.
Yes, Ed, what do you have to say for yourself?
I'm hearing talk about aperture of radar antennas as I turn on the radio. I know a fair amount about that.
Okay, it was actually a rather kind of side view. What really started this out is John WA2VDH had a question about zero voltage gain, even though it would an amplifier with that would feed into a different impedance and have a different power rating. So you know, the capture area is way off in the fringes of this particular conversation tonight.
How have we gone from an emitter follower to a cosecant squared fan beam array?
It's sort of amazing how we can stretch our fingers and reach all kinds of strange things, isn't it?
Hey, give up. I'm going back to whatever. I'm going back to just driving. WB3AZ.
Okay. I'm sorry if I disappointed you, Ed. It's just, like I said, we weren't really talking about aperture ratios, areas. Mike just kind of mentioned it as one interesting a place where decibels are used that's in the subject that we were talking about, decibel ratings and such. Anyone else with any comments tonight on this subject, please feel free to hit that push-to-talk button.
I got my thought back there, Roy, if I could. Very quick.
Late checking.
Certainly, Mike. Go ahead.
Okay, with a late check-in. Okay, as it turns out, now, I just wanted to go back to what something you had said before about the DB, or Bell, if you will, giving credit to Alexander Graham Bell, and that's quite true. But believe it or not, the Bell unit, or decibel unit, or logarithmic unit, has a history traced back to our senses. Because as it turns out, our eyes and our ears, when it comes to sound intensity or light intensity, have a logarithmic type of response. So therefore, in keeping with our sensory perception of the universe, they decided that energy levels should be related to logarithms. Otherwise, the numbers get very, very big or very, very small, and they tried to truncate the numbers based on how we perceive the world with our sensors, believe it or not, with our senses, believe it or not. And again, they gave credit to Alexander Graham Bell at the same time. Back to Net, WY2U.
Yeah, Mike, I totally agree with you. Our senses are logarithmic. They work a lot better that way. Otherwise, we couldn't be able to perceive significant ranges. It was my understanding, it could be wrong, that the Bell was coined initially as part of a way of calibrating acoustics, audio, for human hearing and other such things, and was soon expanded to general power. But yeah, I think its initial use as a logarithmic scale was due to the human senses utilizing that, and visually, sometimes it's a lot easier to understand something using a logarithmic graph rather than a standard Cartesian one.
A quick comment?
Yeah, sure, John.
Yeah, this brings up something that fascinated me in my early days back in the 60s. I remember hearing about log taper potentiometers. I remember I took an audio pot and put it on my Lafayette Voltometer at that time, and I turned it, and I was amazed how very little change, and then bam, all of a sudden a big change in result. And yet that same potentiometer, when I used it to control the volume level audio amplifier from the speaker, it seemed like the volume was going up at a nice linear rate, linear with my rotation of that potentiometer shaft. And I saw in my own meter that it made that sudden logarithmic variation. It's again confirmation that hearing does respond logarithmically, not linearly. But
when you go to buy potentiometers in industrial catalogs, they come in linear taper and audio / logarithmic taper.
Yes, and I saw how that varied on the ohmmeter, how it you could definitely see it was not linear with the turn and rotation in degrees.
Yes, but sometimes you want a linear part, and that's why they both ways. It's very, very application-specific, WB2AB.
Yeah, I learned that when I was about 10 years old, just reading a Lafayette catalog, because they had both models, and I was curious, and I looked into it. And, yeah, I've used linear potentiometers for some circuits, and the audio circuits you work much better with logarithmic ones. A lot of radio receivers these days that put the numbers on the screen, they're related to logarithmic terms, not to linear terms because of that. So, yeah, our visual senses, our hearing senses are logarithmically based, and so that we can compress a great deal of dynamic range biologically. So it is fascinating how biology figures things out long before there was a single electrical engineer.
I like that, Roy.
Well, thank you, Ed. I am happy that you found it quaint. It's fascinating to me. I mean, you know, in medicine, you kind of learn aspects of this. They don't go into the electrical engineering nitty-gritty details. But there's all kinds of very interesting engineering designs that evolution has chosen to kind of simplify things. The bandwidth of visual information would overflow and completely jam our optic nerves. They actually undergo compression algorithms right behind the retina and send a kind of compressed image protocol to the back of our brains, where we decode them and translate them into three-dimensional images for us to look at. So, yeah, biology and electronics and engineering in general have interesting dances with each other.
Oh, comment?
Yeah, sure.
I know I one time spoke to my doctor, and I referred to my glucose tolerance test as a percent overshoot on my glucose response, and looked at me rather strange.
Well, what can I tell you? I mean, nomenclature. Doctors have fancy words for things. Engineers have different fancy words for things. Every specialty develops their own sub-language. If you've ever chatted with lawyers and they weren't really talking down to you, it's kind of difficult to follow sometimes what they're talking about. It's the same with any profession. So, yeah, you use electrical engineering terms. He would use probably for the you know, in medicine, overshooting a standard deviation and such is not clinically what people tend to do. It's just it's above the acceptable range, and that's the way most physicians tend to just look at it rather than give you a value for it.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou. Yes, Lou, you want to say something?
So, an obstetrician, how does he measure dilation? In what units?
Interesting point.
Well, usually in the United States, especially if they're a certain age, in inches. In England, in centimeters.
No. They always say centimeters for some reason. When my wife was in the hospital giving birth twice, they always said centimeters. It was never centimeters.
absolutely wrong. Centimeters. I'm from Europe.
Yeah, I don't quite know where the accent came in with centimeters. It's C-E-N-T. I guess if you come from some strange country, it might end up being pronounced that. But again, it depends on the age of your obstetrician. Nowadays, a lot of people think in terms of kilograms and the metric unit and all that. There are guys out there, I think, still probably using inches. It's easily transferable. It's 2.54 centimeters per inch by definition. There's no extra digits there.
And two extra, yeah?
Finish something.
Yeah, you doubled. Ed first, then Wesley.
You have 30 seconds for a little puzzle before I go in the house and eat dinner before I come back on the net?
Certainly, Ed.
1,000 micrograms is a milligram. 1,000 milligrams is a gram. 1,000 kilograms. Sorry, 1,000 grams is a kilogram. What's 1,000 kilograms called?
As far as I know, it's called 1,000 kilograms. I don't know of anyone that calls it a megagram.
It's a ton.
A metric ton.
Of course, but then if you're not in the United States, you leave off the metric. It's a ton.
Okay. In the United States, I've never... there are people who call it a metric ton. Most people just don't bother with another term. They just say how many kilograms. I mean, if you ever see ridiculous astronomical numbers, they'll say it's something like 1.5 times 10 to the 23rd kilogram. You can use ton. I just don't remember too many people actually doing it in the United States. But you can do it.
All right. Now, let me just finish up. I once flew to Australia after flying from Brisbane to L.A. on a 747-400. I found myself getting off the plane right next to the flight crew. And I said, excuse me, do you have any idea how much fuel will be burned on this trip? And one guy said, I can tell you precisely, 140 tons.
And to exchange.
Yes, Wesley?
Meters. Nanometers, micrometers, not matters, or meters. It's a funk. There is a rule in Eastern Europe, especially in Europe. Every child is being taught tera, giga, megda, ga, kilo, hecta, deca, deci, centimeter, micro, nano, pico, femto, atom. There's a prefixes. Atometer, femtometer, not matter, or meter. Learn proper English, sir, and to exia.
Well, I don't think anyone got down to the femtometers and the picometers. They're used. I've seen it in the literature all over the place. We were talking about thousands of kilograms.
No, I understand. I understand. One thing is presumption and the other one is statement. And to exchange.
Okay. Any other comments out there on this subject? Okay, now there was a guy who just kind of said late check-in. Not quite sure if they wanted to be put on the list or they just wanted to tell me that they're here and they're listening. So if you're out there and you want to be put on the list, let me know. Okay, so I'll assume it was just a late check-in only. Anyone with any amateur-related questions for tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
WB2BXO, how you doing, Roy?
I'm doing fine, Frank. How are you?
Yeah, I have a question about Apple AirTags. I'm curious what some of the guys think of them, but if you want to see if you have some of the amateur radio questions first, that's fine.
Okay, I assume you meant the AirPods, the wireless headphones?
No, there's actually something called an AirTag. that you can put on luggage and keys and such, apparently, and then find it with your iPhone.
Oh, okay. I couldn't make out the T, AirTag. Interesting technology. Other companies have done similar things. There are privacy issues. I like the, you know, find my AirPod, find my iPhone, find my other things, but I've never invested in a separate tag and stuck it on my keys. I'd be curious if anyone out there owns one, has played with it, and finds it a useful device, or has concerns about privacy issues. There have been reported cases of questionable people using it to tag, you know, ex-boyfriends or girlfriends, and just kind of spying on people. So I'm as curious as Frank is about whether anyone out there has any actual experience with this technology. Oh, well, I guess the audience is not familiar with it, or has no opinion of it. Like I said, it's a well-designed product, from what I understand. And, you know, if you tend to lose your keys, it's probably a good thing to add it to your keychain. I'm a little concerned with privacy issues because I don't know exactly how you guarantee that it's not misused by, you know, someone hiding it in your car and then being able to trace you around town as such. It seems, unfortunately, to have some liability issues.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I first heard of them, was the misuse of it to follow women around and, you know, stuff like that. But then I was listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast yesterday, and the guy was describing how he or one of his coworkers used it to chase lost luggage around the world and try to convince the airline of where their luggage had gone to. A rather skeptical airline, apparently. Go ahead.
WB2KW3.
Yes, Cap.
Okay, rather than using one of those devices where essentially it does not require any, I don't know, mutual agreement to follow you around, my family and I use an application on both Android and Apple phones called Life 360, where essentially you form a group, in this case our family, you register your phone to it, and you can find out where the person is. You can also receive notifications when they arrive to certain destinations that you can define. The nice thing about Life 360 is you can say, you know what, I don't want to be tracked anymore. I can disable the application. Or the people, you know, in the group can kick you out of the group. So that's I guess, conquers some of the privacy issues. Basically, you're being tracked by mutual consent.
Okay, I mean, that's a good point, Ken. But Apple already has that kind of built into itself. For cell phones and for iPads, there's the Find My Friends application. You have to send in a request to follow your friend. Your friend then has to approve it, and at any time, they can kick you off of the approved list. So the phones and the iPads, which have much more complex electronics, are capable of doing that fine-tuning. When Apple came up with these simple, relatively simple tags, there's really no way of controlling it, because it would sort of be as if someone took an iPhone that they own, registered with another iPhone that they own, and then secretly put their iPhone in the back of your car someplace. The difference would be that the power would run out sooner, but ultimately you have the same problem of someone being able to trace you without your knowledge and having no rights on that.
Yes, and I don't think Apple was the first. There was another device. I forget what it was called, but it would do local Bluetooth tracking. And if you lost something, you could kind of put it in lost mode. And all of the other devices of this manufacturer, if they detected your device's MAC address, would report through some form of network over the internet. So if you lost a piece of luggage and it happened to have gone to Italy, you could be sitting here in New York and you would be notified that it was there. You didn't have to be in direct contact.
Yeah, I would agree. Apple is certainly not the first. Like most things, Apple generally is not an innovator of a type of device. They only somewhat perfect it. So there are tags available. There are other companies that sell long-distance Bluetooth-based and other-based tags that you could monitor people with. It's just that this one is very successful and very famous and attracts most people's concerns of the technology in general.
Yeah, I'd love to have a tracker small enough to stick on each of my wife's hearing aids, so if they drop out of her ears somewhere and she doesn't realize it till 10 minutes later when we're somewhere else, we'd have a fighting chance of recovering these very expensive items.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the concerns that I had when I saw it, that it is a rather bulbous thing. If it was really, really small, it would probably have more problems in that people could secretly apply it all over the place, like if you've ever seen in any kind of spy movie where they slip trackers and they slip bugs and such. So I agree, it would be nice. What may happen is that hopefully some kind of uniform protocol is agreed upon and more than a few companies will use the same protocol and you'll not be kind of locked in to a manufacturer's set of protocols. But, you know, sometimes that happens, most times it doesn't.
Yeah, well, there's certainly an issue with very, very small ones that can be secreted all over the place, but... you know, it would be real handy for things like hearing aids, which are very small, very easy to lose, and very expensive.
Yeah, but once again, one of the major problems with electronics right now, you know, we have seen revolutions in semiconductor technology, Moore's Law, and all the other things, and yet, unfortunately, the technology of batteries is not keeping anywhere the pace. So... we have this ongoing problem of a technology with a high enough energy density and a safety factor simultaneously. And at this point, we're not anywhere near. I mean, every so often in the old days when I did science talk, we would talk about graphene because graphene has a great deal of potential for all kinds of metamaterials. Fortunately, production costs for pure graphene are ridiculously high, but eventually, like all things, there'll be some clever guy who figures out a much less expensive meme producing them, and then the world will have another revolution on its hands.
Well, we're certainly seeing enough revolutions in the world, both good and bad, and hopefully the good ones will outnumber the bad ones. By the way, I just switched this week to a Verizon Fios connection and ditched the cable company here in Philadelphia. And so far, my connection to Echolink seems better. Of course, I don't really know if that'll keep up. It may drop out in 2 minutes for all I know, but it so far seems better. Anyway, thanks for the input. And I'll be listening off and on. I've got some things to do here. WB2BXL.
Okay, very good, Frank. Glad to have you aboard. Thank you for participating. Anyone else out there with amateur radio-related questions before we move into the science segment? Give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, very well. Wesley, what would you like to talk about tonight?
to routing match into XGN. We had a discussion with Dr. Roy. He is very much conservative in terms of physics, which is absolutely good, absolutely good. Solid and not jumping around, which I am not. So thank you for that. Let me jump. Okay. 2 weeks ago, we had a discussion about the crystals and the photons and the interaction of photons between photons through the crystal. And yes, the gentleman was right, but he didn't want at that time to say that, anything more than that. But looking deep into the subject, I have a quote from Popular Mechanics. The idea behind the double slit experiment is even if the photons are sent through the slits one at a time, there is still a wave present to produce the interference pattern. I was talking at that time about the photons, not the waves. So the wave is a probability because the experiment is set up so the scientists don't know which of the two slits, if any, will have the individual photon to pass through. End of the quote. So now from that we have two things. We have a photon and we have a wave that is mentioned. I can send you that link if it's important. So then the question arises, what is the relation between electromagnetic wave and a photon? That would be one question. And the second question would be, what is the difference between photon and electron? We may also go to the plane waves, but I believe it's too deep. Dr. Roy.
Well, I'm interested. I'm curious why, and I'd rather not talk about plane waves. Why do you think plane waves are deep, but wave-particle duality is not? One of the things that upsets, annoys, and confuses almost anyone who's gotten anywhere near quantum mechanics is the nature that things are not purely particles or purely waves, but some strange admixture of the two. And that's what we tend to call wave-particle duality. Now, it doesn't really mean that they're waves. It doesn't really mean that they're particles. It means that there's something that we can't quite grasp yet. I would think that they are excitations of quantum fields that they behave under some cases as particles and photons. They act as projectiles. They follow the physics of a projectile. And in other times, they operate as waves with interference patterns. Now, if you take and you don't have to give me the source, because I kind of know just about everything written about a double-slit experiment. If you put a detector on the slits themselves, they basically collapse in particle-like behavior. Not because a conscious mind is collapsing the probability wave. It's simply that the detection device is disrupting the wave aspect of the wave-particle duality. And we can go deeper and deeper down this particular rabbit hole into quantum field theory, but I'm sure no one would like to do that.
Yeah, you mentioned particles. A particle falls into having an apparent mass different from its actual mass is called virtual particle. That's from the explanation. And virtual particles, according to quantum mechanics, are represented by waves. So now we have a circle. The absolute square of the wave amplitude represents the probability of finding the particle. The engage theory, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, the potential for momentum performs the role for the virtual particles in mediatory interaction. There's a larger potential for the momentum at some points means a higher probability of finding the related virtual particle at that point. But what I was trying to say is that based on that quote that I just read, a particle is actually an apparent mass different from its actual mass. And it's called virtual particles. So whether we're going to go to the virtual particles or not, the first question that was not answered is what is the relation between electrons.